the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening. My name is Simon, and I'm going to be taking us through the first in a super, super short series called When God Gets Angry. And we are going to be taking a look this week at the book of Nahum and next week at the book of Obadiah. Has anyone ever heard a sermon on Nahum before? Put your hand up. Chris Nash has, Reg has, and Derek has. Okay, we're a little bit in uncharted waters, so we'll see how we go. We're starting this series When God Gets Angry. If you want to look up Nahum, that is on page 886 of the Green Bibles in front of you. Now these guys, Nahum and Obadiah, they are slightly different to your regular Old Testament prophet. And the thing that makes them slightly different is that they are not directly talking to the Old Testament people of God, Judah or Israel. They are actually speaking to the nations that are around them. So this guy Nahum is speaking to Assyria, and this guy Obadiah, who Nick's going to be talking about next week, he's speaking to Edom. So these are prophets who are speaking to the nations around Judah and Israel. Now, I don't know about you, but we've always enjoyed bookshops. I think our favourite at the moment is the second-hand bookshop in Topsham. We love spending time in there, seeing if we can uncover a gem and just generally have a rummage around. But occasionally we'll also go to Waterstones as well. So it's just Waterstones on the High Street. And I was in there just after Christmas, and a book jumped out at me, and it just really caught my eye, really caught my eye. This is the book, and I wanted to show it to you. This is called Abandoned Places, and the title of the book is 60 Abandoned Places, Ghost Towns, Empty Streets, Crumbling Ruins, and Lost Empires. This book reveals these and other deserted places. And the images in the book just absolutely fascinated me. The one on the front cover that you can see there is a place called Bud Ludza, and that is in Bulgaria. And this is the Communist Party headquarters of Bulgaria as it stands today. It was built in 1981. And was meant to be a meeting place for communists for hundreds of years to come. Communism fell in 89 in Bulgaria, and it was pretty much left to ruin. It was ransacked and just left to the elements, and that's how it ends up looking like it does there, in a slight yellow. It's not like that. If you're there, can I show you a couple more? Check out this one. This is Six Flags in New Orleans, and this is a very, very creepy abandoned theme park, and it's been left like this ever since Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005. So a very, very creepy deserted theme park. Or how about this one? This is another favourite. This is in a city in Taiwan, northeastern Taiwan. And this one was never actually populated. Some people just started building these residential tower blocks, but stopped. And nature eventually took hold, and it ends up looking as it does today. That's another fairly creepy, abandoned place. And then I think this one is my absolute favourite. This next one is from Cambodia. And this is a very, very creepy looking building. This is from Angkor. It was constructed in the 12th century as a Buddhist monastery. and it was abandoned in the 17th century. Hence why there is a very large tree growing through the roof of this building. So I was just fascinated about these stories of desolate, abandoned, crumbling places. Well, that's a little bit like what we're going to be talking about this evening, which is the Assyrian Empire. We're going to be looking at how this great, glittering Assyrian Empire ended up collapsing into ruin and becoming empty, desolate, and eventually abandoned. And that's all that Nahum is talking about. He's talking about the great empire of Assyria. So, shall we take a read together of Nahum chapter 1? So, a prophecy concerning Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and vents his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger, but great in power. The Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. His way is in the whirlwind and the storm, and clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and dries it up. He makes all the rivers run dry. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the blossoms of Lebanon fade. The mountains quake before him, and the hills melt away. The earth trembles at his presence, the world and all who live in it. Who can withstand his indignation? Who can endure his fierce anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. The rocks are shattered before him. The Lord is good, a refuge in time of trouble. He cares for those who trust in him, but with an overwhelming flood, he'll make an end of Nineveh. He'll pursue his foes into darkness. Whatever they plot against the Lord, he will bring to an end. Trouble will not come a second time. They will be entangled among thorns and drunk from their wine, and they will be consumed like dry stubble. From you, Nineveh, has one come forth who plots evil against the Lord and devises wicked plans. This is what the Lord says: although they have allies and are numerous, they will be destroyed and pass away. Although I have afflicted you, Judah, I will afflict you no more. Now I will break their yoke from your neck and tear your shackles away. The Lord has given a command concerning you, Nineveh: you will have no descendants to bear your name. I will destroy the images and idols that are in the temple of your gods. I'll prepare your grave, for you are vile. Look there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. They will be completely destroyed. Well, we're introduced in verse 1, take a little look there, to a prophet, and the prophet's name is Nahum. We know he's a prophet, and that's about the sum total of all that we know about this guy. He writes probably around the year 630 or 640 BC. His name, Nahum, means comfort or compassion, which is maybe a little bit strange at first when we see the kind of things that he's writing about. We're told that he is from a place called Elkosh. Did you see that? Nahum the Elkoshite. Likewise, we have absolutely no idea where that is. No idea where that is. But wherever that was, for Nahum, all of life would have been dominated by the big power of the day, would have been dominated by Assyria. Likelihood is Nahum would be born in, live under, and die within the empire, the Assyrian Empire. And at this point in time, the place that he's from, Judah, is effectively a client or a vassal state of that great big Assyrian Empire. It's huge. And whether you're in Memphis in Egypt, Damascus in Syria, whether you're in Jerusalem in Judah, whether you're in Babylon, or whether you're in Nineveh, all of these places came under the sway of this great, impressive, glittering empire of Assyria. They had risen dramatically in the 8th and 7th century BC. You might remember some of the stories from the book of 2 Kings of their huge expansion. And it was an expansion that came with a whole lot of blood as well. Nahum chapter 3 and verse 1 will say, "Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims." These guys had undergone a rapid expansion and in an incredibly cruel and unjust and bloody way. And Nahum lived under this empire. That's where he lived. He's in this place of Judah, and we're only talking about Judah at this point. Israel, that northern tribe, has already been taken away. That's been taken away about 100 years before Nahum writes. They're just dispersed and they vanish from the pages of history. Well, back to Nahum, we know that he's a prophet. And to be a prophet at that time meant you had a very important job to do. Prophets were to speak God's words to whoever God was sending them. Here is a typical prophetic job description. This is from the book of Jeremiah. God says to him, "I've put my words in your mouth. I appoint you over nations and kingdoms to uproot and tear down, to destroy and to overthrow, and to build and to plant." So Nahum was a prophet and he had that important job to do, to speak God's words to whomever God was sending him to. And in this case, it was Nineveh. So let me show you, that's Nahum, again slightly yellow. This is Nineveh. Let me show you Nineveh. So the slightly darker yellow is the extent of the Assyrian Empire. You can see it covering big swathes of Egypt, Syria, Judah, Babylonia, and just a big sweep of the Middle East. And that's at its high watermark. That's as big as it got. So we're introduced to this city, Nineveh, and it's the capital of the Assyrian Empire. If you want to picture where it would have stood, it's modern-day Mosul in Iraq, the same Mosul that's been in our news for the last 2 or 3 months as ISIS are pushed back by a combination of Iraqi and Kurdish forces. We're going to be having a look at praying for Iraq slightly later in the service. So that's where it would have stood, and it had some ambitious and memorable kings. You might recognize the names of people like Sennacherib, Tiglath-Pileser, and Ashurbanipal. Lots of mouthfuls, but these were ambitious Assyrian kings. This particular guy, Sennacherib, he had a very cool building project. He built a great, great palace in the capital, Nineveh, and his building program included awesome waterworks, an incredible water supply, and a massive wall to surround the city. It was the jewel of the empire, and into that city flowed all of the wealth, the slaves, the surplus of this massive expansion project across the Middle East. So it was the jewel of the empire. In fact, there's some strong evidence to suggest that ancient wonder of the world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, they weren't actually in Babylon at all, apparently. They were likely to have been in the city of Nineveh. They were likely to have been part of Sennacherib's great grand palace. Well, at this point in history, it looks like that glittering empire, Assyria, are absolutely firmly center stage. It is impossible to imagine life without these guys. It's impossible to disentangle yourself from the work of this empire. It would have just been impossible to imagine a world without it. Well, Nahum, have a look at chapter 1 and verse 1. He sees a vision. And that's what's recorded in his book. This is a vision that Nahum sees. And it's made up of two parts, really. Nahum has a vision of God, which is chapter 1. And then Nahum has a vision of what's going to happen to Nineveh in chapters 2 and 3. And I think our main point from what we've read from chapter 1 is this. It is that Assyria, the great empire, is not center stage. In fact, no empire ever has truly been center stage. Whether it's Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, run it all the way through history, no empire has ever truly been center stage. Only the Lord is center stage. Have a look at the way he is described in verses 2 and 3. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and vents his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger, but great in power. The Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. Nahum's had this amazing vision of the Lord, and he kind of describes it in the exact same way that Moses describes meeting God. If you have a look at verse 3, that is practically a quotation from Exodus 34. Do you remember the Lord passes by Moses and declares his own name? And whenever we read Lord in big capital letters in the Bible like that, that effectively means Yahweh, which means I am who I am. Nahum's trying to tell us that he's met the Lord almost in the same way that Moses has. He's had this immense, dramatic vision of meeting God. And in fact, it was fairly common kind of saying in the Old Testament that if anyone had met the Lord, they're almost surprised to still be alive. Folks would often say, "We've seen the Lord, surely we'll die." So Nahum has seen this dramatic vision of God, who he is and what he's like. And only once he's seen who he is does he have anything to say about the surrounding nations. Only once he's seen who God is does he have anything to say about Nineveh and God's judgment. Nahum initially just gets shown that the Lord is center stage. That's what chapter 1 seems to all be about. No empire has ever truly been center stage. The Lord is center stage. Or to put it in some language similar to what we're using at the moment in the mornings, how about this? All the armies that have ever marched, all the navies that have ever sailed, all the parliaments that have ever sat, all the kings that have ever reigned, all put together, have not affected the life of mankind on earth as powerfully as that solitary life. All the empires of all the world have never really been center stage. The Lord is center stage. So you might be wondering what inspires one person to speak out against such a tyrannical, scary, intimidating, huge empire like Assyria. And it's someone coming face to face with the Lord Almighty, with the Lord who is good, a refuge in times of trouble, and one who cares for those who trust in him. But with an overwhelming flood, he'll make an end of Nineveh. He'll pursue his foes into the realm of darkness. Nahum meets the Lord who is center stage. So, what might that mean for us today? I think as you're flicking through the newspapers or you're scrolling through the news during the week, those headlines can seem pretty distracting and pretty intimidating too. So when the glittering empires of today distract you and the headlines loom large, I think we should be remembering the one who's truly center stage. We should be remembering that the Lord is in charge of all history. And I don't know if you spotted there as we read Nahum together, that this judgment of that great city is somehow good news for God's people. It's somehow good news for Judah and for Nahum. Take a look at verse 15. Those might look like some fairly familiar verses, actually. They're very, very similar to words that Isaiah will use. Look there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. They will be completely destroyed. The removal of God's enemies brings comfort to his people. What does that look like today? We are not the people of Israel. We do not live in the promised land. We do not live in a geographical or political system that could just be identified solely as God's kingdom. We're followers of Jesus, together here in Exeter, but part of the body of Christ spread throughout all the world. We're followers of Jesus living after his death and resurrection, and we're scattered. We're scattered across the globe. And what this was making me think of in the week was one of the real areas of challenge is in our relation to the persecuted church. Claire and I, when we went to the Calais jungle in the summer last year, we met some Christian refugees, and they were from Ethiopia. These guys, there were some lads, they're aged 16 to 22, three guys, and we had a meal together. We prayed for one another. We even kind of did a kind of hymn battle off, where Claire and I tried to sing some of ours, and those guys were singing some Ethiopian Christian hymns. We had such a great time together, but they shared some of their stories. All of them had suffered under the hands of IS in Libya in various different ways. They'd travelled from Ethiopia to Libya to work fairly menial jobs. And when IS rose in Libya, they found themselves on the end of some pretty harsh treatment. One of the young guys could relate how an uncle of his had been beheaded on the beaches of Libya, and all of them had experienced various types of hardship for their association with the living God. I wonder what Nahum would have to say for them. Surely it's got to be just too cheap to simply overlook those crimes. That's not what our God is like. Surely these lads would have been wonderfully comforted to know that God is going to bring an end to the arrogant and evil empires that are out there, and that he has done through history. Surely that would be of some comfort to them. It would be amazing for them to know and hold on to God's fierce love for them, but also his goodness and his justice that he's going to bring down corrupt, arrogant, evil empires. I was thinking of those crazy phrases that Jesus uses of someone coming to harm a Christian or a follower of his, someone coming to harm one of his little ones, as he phrases it. He says, "If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea." It was making me think of Jesus' fierce love for the persecuted church today. So where that then left me was thinking how little I empathize with these guys, how little I think of myself as suffering because they do, how little I think of myself as part of the same church that they are part of, part of the same body that they are part of. The New Testament says that when one suffers, we all suffer. And so maybe part of that challenge from Nahum is to let our empathy for suffering brothers and sisters increase, and thereby understand and feel the weight of God's fierce love for them and his goodness and justice that works to bring about the downfall of arrogant empires. Well, after chapter 1, Nahum begins to tell us more about what's going to happen to Nineveh. he is going to outline what happens on the day Nineveh falls. Take a look at chapter 2. Have a little glance there. An attacker advances against you, Nineveh. Guard the fortress, watch the road, brace yourselves, marshal all your strength. The Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, though destroyers have laid them waste and have ruined their vines. The shields of the soldiers are red, the warriors are clad in scarlet, the metal on the chariots flashes on the day they are made ready, the spears of juniper are brandished, the chariots storm through the streets, rushing back and forth through the squares. They look like flaming torches, they dart about like lightning. Nineveh summons her picked troops, yet they stumble on the way, they dash to the city wall. And so on and so on. If you take a look at the screens, you can see what Nahum is doing in chapter 2. It's like he's visualizing himself there on the day of battle. He starts saying, an attacker's coming, and he imagines the army advancing. First he sees the line of troops all lined up. Then he sees chariots. Then he's talking about everybody rushing to the wall, then coming over the wall, and eventually Nineveh falling. He's able to see through the eye of faith and his vision how Nineveh is going to fall. And that same is true for chapter 3. After he's talked in detail about how Nineveh is going to fall, he then pronounces woes on the city of Nineveh. Take a look at chapter 3. He says, "Woe to the city of blood, full of plunder, never without victims." Or take a look at the end of chapter 3, verse 19. "Nothing can heal you. Your wound is fatal. All who hear the news about you clap their hands at your fall. For who has not felt your endless cruelty?" We don't have time to read it all, but in chapter 2, he's visualizing the day of battle when Nineveh falls. And in chapter 3, we read about the completeness, not just of the fall of Nineveh, but then the entire empire as well. And that empire that's been built on blood is going to be destroyed. Well, we've read some pretty detailed descriptions from Nineveh and from Assyria of how they'd fall. Nahum was a good prophet. He was a true prophet. How do you tell if someone's a good prophet? Well, if they say something, it comes to pass. It happens. That is the test of a good prophet, and Nahum is jolly well qualified. At the height of the Assyrian Empire, when life couldn't be imagined without it, he says Nineveh's going to fall because God says so. And in 612 BC, it did. That happened. It came to pass. Nineveh was assaulted by a combination of the Medes and the Babylonians, and it was put under a brief siege and fell in just the way that Nahum said it would. The fall of this city and the demise of the empire are complete, and Assyria will not rise again after this. "Nothing can heal you. Your wound is fatal," says Nahum. It was such a complete demise that Nineveh quickly moves out of history. It almost disappears. It goes from history to legend, legend to myth, and then is almost pretty much forgotten about. And that is until a British archaeologist stumbles across the ruins in 1847, a guy called Henry Layard. He finds it again. Yet Nahum wasn't just right in general that this would fall, he was very right in particular. I mentioned that these guys were really, really proud of their waterworks. They're really proud of their canals and their water system. They thought, if we're going to have a siege, we're going to be able to hold on for quite some time. In the fabulous irony of the Lord, it's those very same waterworks that end up destroying Nineveh. Their attackers, the Babylonians and the Medes, they shut the dams. They shut the dams at the edge of the city. They block them all up, and the water builds and builds and builds. They then open the dams, and the water comes rushing into the city and washes some of the wall away such that the attackers can get in. So when chapter 2, when you read of Nineveh being washed away like a flood, but with an overwhelming flood, he'll make an end of Nineveh, or the river gates are thrown open and the palace collapses, or Nineveh is like a pool whose water is draining away. He wasn't just writing poetically, but prophetically too. So we might be left asking, why did it fall? Why did it disappear? And you could answer that in loads of different ways. You could say certain political, economic, military, geography reasons apply. But in the end, Nineveh falls because God says it will. Nineveh falls because God has spoken. He's spoken through the prophet Nahum. And that judgment that's been held back by the God who's slow to anger finally breaks. And with an overwhelming flood, he makes an end of Nineveh. Well, have you heard of the city before? Chances are, if you've had, you've heard about it in this book, in the book of Jonah, where he also prophesies to the city of Nineveh. Nahum prophesies to Nineveh, and so does Jonah. The two are linked. And in fact, Nahum wants to tell us that they're linked by making his book end in the exact same way that Jonah's does. You might know that the book of Jonah ends with a rhetorical question. It ends, "Why should I not pity that great city, Nineveh?" And Nahum wants to show us that those two are linked, and he ends his book with a rhetorical question as well. He says, "All who hear the news about you clap their hands at your fall, for who has not felt your endless cruelty?" Nahum wants to make the point that these two are to be read together. His is the sequel to Jonah, effectively. In Jonah, you saw God's kindness to that city in which they came to repent and the judgment was averted. And in Nahum, we see God's that same message of judgment, but no repentance, no turning around, and the judgment breaks. It hits the city. And we're to hold those two together, the kindness seen in the book of Jonah and the severity seen in the book of Nahum. I think we're to hold those together because those two things hold together within God. He's the one who's slow to anger, but great in power, and will not leave the guilty unpunished. Well, we're going to, in a moment, take some time to pray for Iraq. And I wanted to just tell us, I guess, why we were. It's important to note that the book that we're taking a look at, Nahum, it isn't just about Nineveh. It isn't just about Assyria. It is about all empires of all times. That's why the words look really familiar to books like Isaiah. Behold on the mountain, the one who brings good news, how beautiful the feet, and things like this. They are exactly the same as Isaiah. And Nahum's making the point that the fall of Nineveh is an example of how God is at work in every age. And he'll not allow the arrogant and violent empires of our world to endure. So it was quite striking to me in preparing that the violent oppression and human suffering going on in the ancient city of Nineveh were happening right now in that very same location, in the place of modern-day Mosul. The violent oppression and human suffering of ISIS has been all over the headlines over the last few years. And right now in Mosul, this is a map taken from the 19th of March. You can actually see labelled there on the east of the city, the Nineveh ruins. Gives you an idea of how overlapping these two cities were. And so right now, a combination not of the Babylonians and the Medes, but of Iraqi and Kurdish forces are at work to bring ISIL to justice in that same place. So it seems to me that the current situation of the demise of ISIL's foothold in Iraq and the principles outlined in the book of Nahum should drive home the point that God is at work in every age, and he will not allow the arrogant and violent empires of our world to endure forever. So we're going to spend some time now praying for Iraq, and Jimmy is going to lead us in some of that.